you all for spending your lunch with me today. I'm very honored that you would take the time to come out and hear a Black History Month speech. You know, I wanted to let you know my perspective on Black history. You know, when I was in grammar school, they didn't have Black history. It's like you just learned history. And, you know, that's almost like a way of saying, we're only going to learn this special secret thing right here, but we're not going to learn anything else. So the reason I'm proud to celebrate Black history is because it's really highlighting American history, but highlighting an American history that is not often covered in a traditional way. So for that reason, I'm very excited to return to my alma mater. It's always a thrill to come down here now. It's so funny. It takes a few years for that thrill to take effect. I just want you to know, just so that I'm honest about this and real. You know, the first few months after you graduate, it's like, oh, Lord, I can't drive that drive. I can't go to Charlottesville. But that, at some point, that goes away, and it is replaced with a great fondness. It is replaced with a great and healthy respect for the experience that you have here. And I hope to win that into my talk, because I am going to do a little about history, because the past is very much a prologue for the present and very much something that you can use in your future. Even though I studied international economics at Georgetown, history was my favorite subject. And it's because human behavior does not ever change. It really is the same. And it doesn't matter whether we're studying, you know, the post-period or the pre-period. Pretty much people have been people. And they have behaved in very similar ways over time. And so if you know a little bit about how people look at the world, then you have a sense for what the future might be like. And I know, you know, this is an interesting time, I think, to be a law student, right? So much change, so much first, so many firsts, so much different than what you really would have expected when you entered law school, but at the same time, so much chaos, so much turmoil, so much work, so much uncertainty about what you face. And I mean, the good news is, you're a student this year, so no matter what the economy does, right, you pay for this year. This is one year that you don't have to worry about. So there's always a good morning. Hey, by the time it's over, maybe they'll have worked a lot of this out, and everybody will be ready for you guys to come out and make it right. So I always look at it that way. See, we're waiting for y'all to make it right, because, you know, we're getting tired. You know, I graduated in the 80s, so I'm waiting for y'all to come. You know, obviously we've done what we were going to do. It's time for you guys to come and make it right. So I want to start out my talk with a quote, and good thing you're not filming me, you're just taking my picture, because I have this quote written in my BlackBerry, because sometimes, you know, you need to inspire yourself. And I find that when I want to remember something, I write it on my BlackBerry. And, you know, people always look at me like, this is like, sometimes people will be talking, I'll be taking notes. And it's because they're saying something that I really, and if you were to go through my BlackBerry, you could be inspired all day long, because I must have about 100 things in here that I use. So I want to start with a quote from Frederick Douglass. And I will tell you, if this were trial, I would have memorized this quote. But this is to show you real time. I have not memorized this quote, but I love this quote, so I'm going to read it to you. In the words of Frederick Douglass, "If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet deprecate agitation are men who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. The struggle may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. Men may not get all they pay for in this world, but they must certainly pay for all they get." And when I think about his words, I think about really not just history, but your own personal experiences, right? You know, you're here today because you were willing to make some sacrifice. You continue to be here because you're willing to make some sacrifice. And so I thought that for Black History Month, I would talk to you about two lawyers, and because I like symmetry, one woman and one man. And the woman is Charlotte E. Ray, who was born in January of 1850. I'm a January person, that's why you get the month and not just the year. And she lived until 1911. She died on January 4th. Charlotte E. Ray is the first female lawyer to be licensed in the District of Columbia. Notice I didn't say the first African-American woman. I said the first female lawyer to receive a license in the District of Columbia. She is the first African-American woman to become a lawyer. She graduated from Howard University. When she went, right, even then, she knew that she wouldn't get in if she applied as Charlotte Ray. Charlotte Ray would not have gotten into law school. But C.E. Ray could get into law school, and that's who she applied as. And she was very successful in law school. She excelled. Her grades were above and beyond. And her area of expertise was commercial law. But as you might imagine, back in the 1880s or so, she wasn't exactly looked upon as a heralding of a new day. She wasn't thought to be an innovator. Nobody was all excited that she had gotten her law degree, that she passed the bar on the first time back in the day. They were really just not happy she was there. And in fact, ultimately, she had to stop practice. She was not able to get a job in a traditional way. But she started her own practice, and in fact, Professor J. Clay Smith at Howard has unearthed documents that demonstrate that she did, in fact, practice law, and there's a family case, and those historical documents, I'm not sure exactly where they are now, but he referenced them in his book, Rebels in the Law. So she really did practice, she really did file pleadings, but because she couldn't get clients, a familiar refrain, right, something you hear even now, because she couldn't get clients, she stopped, and she eventually moved to New York, where she married and became a teacher. But she was very active in the suffrage movement. She was very active in the NAACP. And I think her life is really a great example, certainly to me, even now, because when you follow your dream and you don't let anyone change how you feel about your dream, that, you know, in other words, if she had stopped practicing and become some bitter old woman who lived her life, that would have been a really great tragedy, I think. Even with the great accomplishment that she would have achieved, but for the fact that she continued to see that society wasn't ready for her. If anything, she recognized that she was ahead of her time, and she honored that. So let's move forward a little bit to another person, a second person, once again a person whose name starts with C, and this is Charles Hamilton Houston. It's funny that their names are Charlotte and Charles, but it makes it easier for me to remember all the things I have to tell you about them. And I'm going to start with a quote by him, and the quote really sums up how he became who he was. He fought in World War I. He was born in 1895, so now fast forward, right? He's born toward the end of Charlotte E. Ray's life. So she's already been a pioneer, and now he comes along, and he too is a pioneer in his own right. He fought in World War I. And after he while he was serving in the war, he was quoted as saying, "The hate and scorn showed upon us," and he's talking about back then Negro soldiers, "shown upon us by our fellow Americans, left me with the sense that, you know, I didn't want to die in a world ruled by these people, right? If they could treat me this way as a fellow American, I don't know that I want to fight really hard and die in a war where this is what's going to be the outcome, that people would treat me this way." And he said, "I made up my mind that if I got through this war, I would study law and use my time fighting for those who couldn't fight for themselves." And I mean, what a wonderful, you know, I mean, you see, like there are those who would think, well, you know, if you treat me this way, then I'm, you know, going to be mad at everybody forever and hate. But he recognized that he couldn't let the world be run by people who couldn't see that. And so what did he do? He dedicated his life to changing that, to changing what was the rule of law then, which was Plessy versus Ferguson. And what is he known as today? He is the architect of the cases that led to Brown versus Board of Education. And he is also best known, and it's so funny, I use quotes by him that you don't hear, right? You normally hear, you know, that if you're not a social engineer, you're a parasite on society. So that's the one that everybody quotes. But ultimately, I think this quote really says a lot more about who he is. Because this quote says, you know, here I am fighting this war against, right, the most evil phenomenon that we can imagine at this time in the world. And I'm being shown such scorn by people who are basically my people, right? Fellow Americans. But yet, I'm not going to use my time to be bitter about this. I'm going to use my talent to fight the war that needs to be fought.
the war for the people who can't fight for themselves. So he went to Amherst College, he went to Harvard for law school, and in fact, he was the first Black African American. It's very frustrating when you go back far in time, because you know I don't want to call him a Negro, but it's not quite African American yet, so we're gonna call him Black for this time. And so he is really the first editor of the Harvard Law Review who was Black. And I mean, this should say to you that he could have done anything. He was the best and the brightest. I mean, look at me. If there were some jobs for Black people, right? If there's only one job when you get out and we're only going to take number one, he was it, right? He was the one. And he could have done that. He could have easily put his shingle somewhere and, you know, we might have the Hamilton Houston house now. But the truth of the matter is he decided that he was going to do something bigger than that. And I think, you know, you think about it, that's why you remember him and not the guy who went off and did that. Because he made a decision that he would train lawyers. Imagine being able to say you trained Thurgood Marshall. Imagine you were able to say, you know, you trained all these other lawyers and you became dean of really the greatest students, I think, as a group to graduate from a single institution and make such a change on who we are, on how we look today in this classroom, if it weren't for them. So I started talking about them because I thought to myself, if I were you, and someone were coming to talk to me and they graduated, I was going to talk about leadership and being all you can be and how wonderful the world will be when you get your law degree. I would still be nervous about what the world is like. You know, I mean, unless you just don't read the paper or watch TV or live in the world or turn on your BlackBerry and get emails from the other people, then you would have stress. You know, you'd have some concern about what the future holds, you know, whether you spent this money and you invested it in a good way, whether there was going to be something for you at the end of this 3 years, whether, you know, what impact all this is going to have on your future. You would be, like I said, living in a very small cocoon if you didn't have that thought. And so I thought I would start by talking about them because really they made a way out of no way, right? They made a way where there wasn't a path, there weren't people who'd done it before them, and it wasn't just they were first generation, they were first everyone's generation. But yet, they were able to do that thing that Frederick Douglass talked about. They recognized that there would be a struggle. They recognized that they would have to make a way out of no way. And I say that to remind you that everyone here has had a struggle. A struggle that I might not be able to guess at, a struggle that you may not have told your friends, but you've had to overcome something. You're not just sitting here because you were kind of in college and having a great time. You thought, I want to go to law school at UVA. And voila, a letter came from on high and said, come, join us, one and all, and we will pay, we will be free, there will be food, there will be, you know. That didn't happen. Some other stuff happened in the meantime. You know, there were some tears, maybe. There were some struggle. There was some angst. And through all of that, you now sit here. And I say that to remind you that there can't be a triumph without a trial. Since then, they go together, right? In order to have the triumph, you have to have the trial. And the trial is something that you've done many times before. Maybe it was a smaller trial. Maybe it was a bigger trial. Maybe that bigger trial is the trial that gives you the strength to do the trials that you do every day and don't pay attention to. Maybe that trial is the trial that gives you the blinders to say, oh, it's a bad day today, but I rise another day and we'll just keep right on going. Maybe it's a trial that really sets the tone for how you're going to face whatever the next trial is. But at the end of the day, there can be no triumph, right? There can be no degree without that trial. So when you think about what's going to happen in your future, you don't have control over what money people lost in the market or what houses they sold that weren't worth what they were worth, what people stole from other people, what people are now getting bailouts for stuff they did that they shouldn't have done, that if you had done them, you would not be bailed out, right? You have no control over that. I remember once I opened my paper, you know, this. I swear to God, I get the post every morning. I had to turn the headlines over. I couldn't get off the house if I read the headlines every morning. But I remember this one article I read, and you know what the guy said? He said, yeah, you know, everybody's saying it's bad. They're predicting gloom. He said, you know, just get up, go to work, do your best, take your money, pay your bills. I remember thinking, now that's the best advice I have seen. I mean, all this stuff, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, I'll confess to you, my experiences have led me to conclude I'm not waiting for anybody to come back and get me. Okay, I'm not hoping that there's going to be a bailout that says, this is the Kim Keenan bailout. I'm not hoping for it. I'm not looking for it. Even when they read, you know, they say, these are the terms, and this is what, I'm always looking at it going, you know what? I'm not expecting that. I'm not looking for that. I'm just going to get up every day, go to work, do my best, try to make a difference. And you know what? I think the rest is going to work itself out. And so I say to you, if you're looking for jobs or if you're interviewing for jobs, and you know, I remember, you know, when you're first year, right, they tell you to apply for a job. I still have my letters. If somebody ever challenges me on this, I tell you, we have to go in the basement for hours, but I have these. I have 100 letters that I sent as a first year. And I received 100 no's. And each of these no's is very special, right? Because I have, each no is very special. I have no's that are like, you are so fabulous and wonderful, and you go to that most auspicious law school, and you know, you are fabulous, but you know, we can't take all the fabulous. We have to let some fabulous go. You are fabulous, we have chosen to not take. And then I have letters like, no, you knew better when you applied to us. I don't know why you sent the letter anyway, but you did. And so we have to tell you no, because you know the answer was nothing. So of those 100 no's, it was pretty, I have to say, after a while, you just get fascinated with how people tell you no, right? It's like, that wasn't very nice what I think they said there. But one of those no's hired me that summer. And I tell that story because you just never know. You never know. And if you let the no be the thing that stops you, then you could go home now, because you're going to get no's. I can promise each one of you in this room that somebody's going to tell you no. But is it really about the no, or is it about the yes? And it's about the yes. You only need one yes, right? If it's the right yes, it can be a great yes. Now, it might be a small yes, a yes that opens a tiny door and it gets your foot somewhere that takes you somewhere else. Or it might be a big yes, a yes where you can spend 10 years of your career and learn everything you need to know. There are all kinds of yeses, just like there are all kinds of no's. There are yeses that will lead you not far or nowhere, but all you really need is one yes to get you on your way. 100 no's don't stop you unless you let them. And so I came to tell you that because I think history, and I like that, you know, it's Black History Month in that sense, because that history is all around you. That history is a part of you. That history is a part of the past. And that history will have some impact on the future. But the good news is it's better than it was. It's better than it was. You're all here. I see a room that much more diverse than any room I ever sat in when I was here. And that's always nice to see. And I will tell you that part of the richness of your experience is having that. Part of the richness of your classmates' experience is having all these different experiences. Because remember now, you're going to represent people. And if they all looked alike and they were all the same, then there really would be a crisis in the legal community, because there wouldn't be a big enough pie for all of you to practice. But the reality is that all day, every day, you really don't know who you're practicing with. You really don't know what people's background is. Somebody might look a certain way, but when they go home at night, their house may look like your house, or your house may look like their house. And I really know. See, the reason that never bothers me, like some of this stuff, you know, people talking about diversity, and I'm like, you know, the day's gonna come where people aren't gonna know. They really aren't gonna know. I was at the Spirit Awards for the ABA, and I'm president-elect of the bar. I'm not president yet. We're gonna let Bob keep that another few months. I'll take it in June. But I was at the ABA, and they had the Spirit Awards, which are dedicated to people who have really done things to promote diversity in the profession. And this year, they gave their corporate award out to Exelon Corporation. And I believe his title is General Counsel. He got up, and you know, he talked about how they do what they do, and how they care about that the law firms are diverse, and how they care about, you know, who works on their matters, and they care about how their company is comprised, and that they, again, it's not about what color you are, it's having the best and the brightest, but having those people reflect the universe. I tell people it's like a bouquet of flowers, right? When you go buy flowers, you don't go, okay, I gotta have one red rose, but one has to be yellow.
or there can only be two yellow and only three red. I mean, that's just foolish. You pick the best grouping of the flowers to give you the best bouquet that you can get. And that's all the challenge I have for America, just that you just pick the best of what there is, and that you try to make sure that you cover in a way that your flowers are reflective of what flowers look like. And when you tell people that, they kind of look at you like, oh, so it's not about a quota of flowers. It's not about we can only have a certain color flowers. It's about making sure that your flowers reflect the song of what they can look like when they all work in concert. So this gentleman was giving his speech, and at the end of his speech, he said, I'm not going to look over there. And he pointed to the table. And, you know, you never know who's at the table, you know, because you're sitting in the audience, too. And I was kind of behind the table, so I really couldn't see who was at the table. So he's like, well, I'm not going to look over there because it's too emotional for me. And so he goes through all these things and, you know, his commitment to this and, you know, and how that's how his company's bottom line is met and how they get what they get done. So at the end, he thanks his family and he thanks his son. His son had, like, blonde dreadlocks. I mean, he had blonde, and I can see from the back, because, you know, they're big. Dreadlocks are big. You can't miss those in the room. You know, it's like, you want to point out the person with the dreadlocks, it's usually easy to find them. And it turns out that his wife is African-American. And I don't know that, from sitting behind them, I couldn't even tell that. So, see, I didn't even know, I was sitting in the same room, but I wasn't sitting in front of the table, I sat behind the table. And you could have heard a pin drop when he said that. People were like, yeah, I mean, if I feel like when I worked in Dallas, the job that I got that they told me no was in Dallas. And here it is. It's the 80s, and I am the first black person they've ever hired that doesn't clean or cook. So, and I'm a summer associate. I'm not even a real associate. I'm a summer associate. And, I mean, I would get people coming up to me saying things to me like, you know, you're first. And that's how they talk to you, like they're translating it for you. You're first. You know, you're like, just what I needed to know to make my whole day today, right? But like every time we go somewhere in Dallas and we walk into a room, stuff would fall. You'd hear like, if we walked into a restaurant, you'd hear silverware all around the room, and it would just be so, I mean, at some level, it's good to be young, because, you know, stuff that wouldn't be funny later, it's really funny when you're in your 20s. You're like, it's like, are people dropping silverware? I mean, I will say this, I always say now, I know what it's like to be a rock star, because, I mean, people would stare at me. They would, I'm telling you, drop their silverware. I mean, think about it. I walk in with five white men in Stetsons. Like, go sit down. There's a part of you that has to, you have to pull that off with some style. Like, yes, But then there were nights when we'd go to, like, the Dallas Country Club. And, you know, somebody who worked at the country club come up and go, you know, black people know. You're like, am I going to get home? Am I going to make it back to my car? I drove here alone. I don't have no people here with me. But you know what? It's fine. It's fine. It really is. You know, a lot of times people don't know what to think. And you have to help them along. That's really your gift to them. And so when he said this, I really believe that people were stunned. But it really makes my point that, you know, the day is really going to come where you don't know people just because you see what they look like. You don't know who their people are. You don't know who their family is. You don't know who they've been exposed to. And, you know, I think it's all rather presumptuous of people, you know, to look at you and make some decision about who you are. And I'll be honest with you, in my career, it has been a tremendous advantage. A tremendous advantage. Because when people come at me and they think they know, like, oh, I know what school you went. People will try to guess what school I went to. I'm like, now how you gonna guess because you're looking at me what school I went to? I want to know how you do that. You know, and they're always wrong, so I know they can't do it. That makes me, but the difference is I already know who I am. I know where I come from. I know what makes me me. And that is a distinct advantage because then people are lost because then their assumptions are challenged. And so, you know, I say that to you to say that, you know, there will be people who don't get it. There are people everywhere who don't get it. But there'll be, I will tell you, tens of more people who will get it. And I think that's what you have to be like Charles Hamilton Houston and say, I'm not going to let the people who don't get it rule the world. Because that would be a horrible, terrible thing. But for the people who can get it,
I have time for that. So when, you know, Erica was saying, well, you have all these things to do, you know, how can you come here? You know, part of me was kind of like, yeah, but I remember what it was like to be this age, this time, this point in law school. And I remember, you know, kind of feeling like I was out there on an island somewhere, you know, like Survivor Island. That's how I felt. You know, trying not to be voted off. Trying not to be, you know, like, okay, I was trying to fit well within the island, you know. And that's not always a good feeling because, you know, you do feel a little sort of alone with that, and you're not alone. I mean, that's the thing. That's why I talked to you about Charlotte E. Ray and Charles Hamilton Houston, because you're not alone. People did this before you. I pray to God that people will do this after you, even though it's not pretty out there. And I know that each of you makes a difference. No matter who you are, or where you're from, or exactly what you look like, or exactly where you come from, you make a difference. And I will tell you this, that no matter how enthused or unenthused on any given day you are about your law experience, isn't that diplomatic? I can say this to you with all assurity. You will be able to make this law degree jump and holler. And that's really all it's about. At the end of the day, it's whether you can make it jump and holler. I've seen, so funny, I never worked anywhere that I hadn't met a classmate that reminded me of somebody that I met somewhere later. And if you think people are cutthroat over grades, just imagine what they're like over money. Right? We're fighting for bonus and place and seniority. You think the fight was bad now? Y'all just talking about some paper. Now we're talking about the real paper. So, you know, this is really great training for you. And I have to tell you, it's, I don't like to do the count. But let's just say it's been decades. And I can tell you, you can make this degree jump and holler, and you will find along the way that your classmates will circle back. You know, I'm going to be president of the bar in the summer. And half the time I got the question, I was like, are you following Melvin? Because Melvin White and I were classmates, and he's immediate past president. I'm like, I'm not following. I mean, it's like they feel like I took it from Melvin or something. It's like there's a person in between me and Melvin, if it makes you feel better. But my classmate Maria Boyle is about to be sworn in. When I get sworn in, she'll be sworn in as president of the Louisiana State Bar. And I do believe she is the first African-American woman to be president of that bar. I will only be the second or the third woman of color and the eighth woman overall. So there haven't been that many women that do this. But I think, I don't let people decide what I'm going to be by how I look. If I did that, like I said, I'd be home now. I wouldn't be here with you. And you have to decide. It's all about what you decide that you want to do. It's about, you know, by the time you get to Charles Hamilton Houston, it's about him saying, I want to do this thing, and making that thing happen. And so, you know, if I can leave you with anything, you know, I would say I do believe one person makes a difference. I do believe you have the power. I think you have to decide that you want to harness that power and focus it and do something. You know what I'm best known for at law school? So funny. You see Steve King. So funny. I worked for placement. I was all about the placement, let me just say. Two things everybody knew about me. I always went to D.C. on the weekend. And the only place I wanted to work in the whole white world was D.C. Now, I know I told y'all I went to Dallas for the summer, but I'm telling you now, if you meet anybody with law school and you say, do you remember Kim Keenan? Oh, yeah, she wanted to go to D.C. I mean, that's it. That's all I answer you. She wanted to go to D.C. So I say that to say, if you have a goal and you say it enough, pretty soon everybody else will be saying it with you. Kim's going to D.C. And what happened? I went to D.C. And I'm still there. So, you know, you have to decide what your goal is and not ever be deterred. And, yeah, you know, my mom used to say, you know, you're going to get knocked down. You're going to fall. But the question is, are you going to get up? We know you're going to fall. We know you're going to get a no. We know it's not going to be easy. I mean, if it was going to be easy, then wouldn't more people do this? Right? Why would you put yourself through this if everybody could do it and it was just so basic that it could be done? No, more people don't do this because it's not easy. You've chosen a path that fewer people choose, so now you have to decide and believe in yourself and trust in yourself enough to know that you can make it so. So those are my words of wisdom. I'm very tickled to be here. I've left time for questions because I know that sometimes you just want to hear it from somebody else. You want to hear a different perspective. I teach. I just got done teaching. I teach at George Washington University Law School, and I teach pretrial advocacy with Dean Alfreda Robinson, and I teach trial ad with Stephen Salzberg, who some of you may know because he used to teach here, and he does teach the trial advocacy program for Virginia. I teach in that too, by the way, so if you ever have a chance to do that, I commend it highly to you. In fact, I'll tell you some reasons for taking it that people don't normally say. I'm really into that. See, the placement background comes in. Okay. The course is taught by a lot of D.C. lawyers, big firms, small firms, professors, you know, people who have really done cutting-edge things. Boy, what a wonderful opportunity to get to spend a little time with them. Right? And get your classwork in, too. You know, a lot of times students don't think that way, but you're going to be there with all those people, and a lot of the people taking the class, what are they? Oh, lawyers in law firms. You know, it's such a great access. You know, the thing about law school is you really don't spend time with the people that you want to be, which is kind of doesn't make sense sometimes, but your schedule goes here, and I got to tell you, real world schedule goes here, because, you know, we don't get breaks, and we don't have, you know, so for us, it's all just another day in the working hood. So you want to, you know, every chance you can get to be near people who are doing something for real, you know, make that opportunity. I wish I had known. I did not know they had it when I was here. I'm mad at Steve for that, but I guess he's making up for it by making me teach it. But it is a delight and a joy to come down here and do it in January. So I don't know whether you have to come back early to do it or whatever, but it is really a fantastic experience. You get all your credits in a really short period of time. Hey, one last class, yet another reason to take it. But it is wonderful, and we teach something very similar to that at GW, and it's, again, a wonderful opportunity to reconnect with the student and all of us. It helps keep us sharper, I think. It helps keep me sharper. I really focus a lot on mediation when I teach, and that's what I did Friday for 7 hours. We actually mediated an employment discrimination case and we reached a resolution. But again, every opportunity you can to do something that you think you'll do when you're done, the practice, right? It's the practice of law. It's not the perfection of law. It's the practice of law. So every chance you get to practice, you practice. And that's how you get bang for your buck at your university. And like I said, your UVA education will take you everywhere in the universe. I really never feel. I mean, I've been at depositions where people are leaning over in the middle of my questions. Where'd you go to law school? And I'm like, I don't answer questions when I'm taking a deposition. I'm there to ask you questions. I get paid to ask questions, not to answer questions. Maybe someday that will happen, and I pray that it will. But right now, I get paid for the question. So if someone asks me a question in a deposition, I say things like, oh, doctor, we can get to that later. Let me return to my question, which is blah, blah, blah. And we never get back, by the way. I never answer the question. I don't answer when it's over. I certainly don't answer when I'm paying the reporter by the word. So I definitely don't answer when it's over because I'm done. My time is up. I must go. So. And you can do all that with a smile on your face. Amazing what time does. You know, 20 years later, you're like, sorry, can't answer that right now. Because I know I'm not going to, so I don't even have to get upset about it. So. If you have any questions, you know, anything about, I clerked, just to give you some flavor for what I did do when I left here, I clerked for 2 years in U.S. District Court in the District of Columbia, and then I went to work for what was the largest law firm in the country, Shark Tank. That's what the book is called, if you ever want to read about my law firm. It was called Shark Tank, and it imploded, and they did lay a lot of people off while I was there, but I billed so many hours they did not lay me off, but I don't know whether that was a good thing. And then I left and went to a boutique firm. So I went to literally the opposite firm. I went from billing my hours to doing complex medical malpractice cases that were contingency. And then I left there and started my own practice, which the timing might have been a little bad because now I'm bar president-elect and that's a part-time job. So now I have my own practice and a part-time job, which is kind of funny. So that should give you a flavor for some of the stuff I'm doing for your questions. But